That's the sound of a piano composition written by Blind Boone, an African-American musician born in Missouri at the end of the Civil War. The name, Blind Boone, wasn't a gag or a stage persona. Blind Boone was actually blind as a result of meningitis, which people treated back then by removing the patient's eyeballs and sewing the eyelids shut. Very little of Blind Boone's music was preserved in recordings or on sheet music, but we do know that Blind Boone was considered a genius. He lived in Columbia, Missouri, and toured nationally. What you learn when you leaf through Sonny Gibson's new book, 1865 Kansas City, Early Negro History, is different. In an editorial on what was then called the Negro Question, you learn that a white hotel proprietor in a Kansas town broke her contract with Blind Boone. After agreeing to provide room and board to Boone and his company, she told the musician that she had reconsidered and would not be able to receive him, offering no further explanation. In Sonny Gibson's book, you learn not what Blind Boone's music sounds like, but what his life might have been like, and what African Americans in Kansas City at the time had to say about it. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm pleased to welcome historian Sonny Gibson to Central Standard to talk about his book. Hi, Sonny.
Good morning.
So this book is a collection of articles, advertisements, photographs, letters, legal documents, memorabilia of all kinds. It's huge, 482 pages to be exact. And what you don't do is write a narrative around all these things. You just let them speak for themselves. Can you talk about that decision?
Excuse me. Yes, I think each article has its own forceful truth about what actually occurred at the time or the specific day that the news was written. So therefore, it's unquestionable. I try to do this book in the first party. I'm really not there. And so people have to look at how people were thinking, how they were feeling, how they were living through the articles that was written on the day and time of the event.
You put them, the order is kind of interesting. I had to sort of get used to just like living in this stuff because it wasn't totally chronological and it wasn't really totally thematic, but there did seem to be some kind of connection usually between what you just saw and what you're looking at next. Can you talk about then, since you made yourself invisible in this book, how did you decide what you wanted to be placed next to what other item?
I did that because I found out that most people sometimes that get a book, they're looking for something specific. And as soon as they find it, they will put the book down. So chronologically, I did some things in some a natural order, but I tried to design the book so that once a person looks at one page, they begin to wonder what's on the next page. And so that's how I placed all of the information that I obtained.
That is pretty clever because it's almost like you don't want people to be able to find what they're looking for. You want them to discover something they never would have thought to look for.
Right.
Well, where did you find all of this stuff? I mean, it's incredible.
a lot of people ask me this, and I went about maybe 25 years ago, started collecting different pieces of information because the history of the early Negro is either hidden or it was purposely excluded. So I had to search. I went to flea markets, old early newspapers, and then people began to give me pictures and articles. And then I collected them. It took me about 2 years to get the book together.
Can you tell me more about yourself and what motivated you to take on this project 25 years ago?
I used to be, when the Charlie Parker Memorial Foundation was alive at one time, I served as its chairman. And because of the jazz idiom, you find that a lot of people all over the world are very much interested. And so many of them came to Kansas City to research and look up different things about jazz. But what I found out after I read their books or their publications or whatever, then I always found out that it was changed. And I realized then that people, based on the educational values, will research, but they will record what their education tells them. And in the early years, it was much different. So I choose to not write in this book. I just choose to tell you what actually happened on whatever date. And that's how I did it.
You use the word, just now, you use the word Negro, and you use the word Negro in the title of the book. It appears throughout the book, as does the word color. Can you talk about those two words?
Yes. I have been highly criticized about that by my contemporaries. But at the time that all this information was gathered and I looked at it and reviewed it, I always saw Negro. I always saw colored, sometimes spelled C-O-L-U-R-O-U-D, not C-O-L-O-R.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the emphasis throughout the book is placed on the early Negro. They were not identified as blacks as such or African Americans as such. You go far as you go back, it's either colored or Negro. And so the information was relative to that.
What kind of surprised me when I saw those words come up is it's surprising to see those words used in a context that where the message itself is not racist. I mean, where the message itself is sometimes even intended to be empowering or really progressive when it comes to race. That was really unfamiliar to me. Was it unfamiliar to you? Were you expecting that, or was it surprising?
Well, it wasn't really unfamiliar to me. I'm 77 years old, so I can remember when the ethnocentric position was that you were either Negro or colored. And so that's why I tend to just play an emphasis on the Negro. I think that it's the Negro's history is very great. It is much more objective than what you hear today about African Americans. And so they went through a struggle, I mean, just to survive. But
It sounds like, is this a word that, Negro, is it a word that you're comfortable using today in just as a word outside of the context of writing a book about history?
I'm very comfortable with it because I lived it, you know, during a time when most people today, specifically young African Americans, tend to find it to be an insult for them to be referred to as a Negro or as colored. And that's because the time segment of maybe being born today, they're not exposed. It's sort of, to me, real artificial because everything that they have today is a result of the Negro who come through an ocean of blood and tears trying to reach a point where they could pass on.
So it sounds like you associate that word with that struggle, the struggle of blood and tears.
Yes.
Wow. It's a different way to hear about that word than I've ever heard about it. A lot of the articles in this book that you've compiled come from a newspaper called the Interstate Herald. What was the Interstate Herald?
The Interstate Herald was a newspaper that surfaced around the late 1800s. I found quite a few actual newspapers in the Missouri archives in Columbia where these newspapers are. And also in the Missouri Valley Room, there are a few of them. But it was a very stately publication. And it tells me at that time there were people of color who were educated enough to get into the communications field.
Yeah, it seems to be a newspaper written for and by black people.
Yes.
At a time when that's not something that my history lessons have taught me about what that history was.
Yeah, well, what made me look into this and try to start at the year 1865, you know, understanding that Kansas City was incorporated in 1850, and there's a lot of history about that, and in many books. But at that time, you had the Negro who owned businesses and lived very stable, and there was no mention of segregation as such in those early years. I mean, the Negro lived wherever he could afford to live. Segregation only came, I guess, in force around 1900s or thereafter. But I think that it might have been inadvertently excluded. I really don't know. I haven't met anybody who could tell me about that. But there is no, it's a hidden history, in other words.
There are some of the editorials from that paper are gut-wrenching to read, partly because in 2014, we're still having different versions of the same conversations. Like, there's one editorial where it's a black author talking about how he wishes some of these younger people would present themselves differently and dress differently. And that's a very public argument that we've heard playing out recently, just the definition of how people are dressed and how they should dress. That's changed. But the conversation is disturbingly similar.
Because the issues are similar today. The early Negro had another kind of drive for a better or proper education than today. And so what happens is, I think that the culture itself, where you extend or contribute to ideas, values, and dress as such, is passed on. But somewhere, and I'm highly criticized by my contemporaries for thinking this, it fell down. I mean, people was trying to probably do something that they didn't really understand what they were doing. And so they...
What do you mean by that?
they made an escape, and they began to try to be like some other entity, some other group, rather than trying to be like themselves, you see.
What do you think it would have meant to be like themselves?
I think that if you look through the book, you would find some distinction as to how the early Negro presented themselves, how they tried to accomplish things when they were inside of an invisible boundary. And so they knew not to step outside its boundaries. So they had to look within themselves, all their skills to provide services and benefits and opportunities and employment.
What are some examples from the book that you would say really highlight that, that show the kind of distinction you're talking about?
Well, there were several businesses that survived, for instance. It had to have a concept by someone who had an abstraction in their thinking, because the first Negro shopping center in America was located right there at 19th and Vine. And so then you had an individual, Homer Roberts. He had the first Negro or first new car dealership in America right here in Kansas City. And so they sold new cars, not used cars, new cars to people in the community. So they had to work and be real thrifty to afford these automobiles. So that's one thing.
I was really struck by all the news headlines relating to property ownership, as well as the language used in writing about it. Black people buying property was clearly seen as news at a certain point. Really lengthy period. There's an article, for example, that ran in 1923 with the headline, "Negro Buys $70,000 Building." That is a news headline is incredible. Can you talk about how you felt when you came across that newspaper article and what it says to you that it was important enough to include?
I think that based on the income and the availability of capital, I think that article is speaking to Homer Roberts. He built this building for $70,000. $70,000 was a lot of money today, but it was a lot of money then. The capitalization was something that was noteworthy for an individual under some dire circumstances to make that leap and to build a building. Yes.
Well, you found this. I don't know where it comes from, and I'd first of all like you to explain it to me. There's this 1910 breakdown of what a document refers to as colored people versus white people in terms of population size, property ownership, tax paying, per capita wealth. It's got a really ornate border around it. And I don't know, do you remember what this document is, where it comes from?
Well, you have 400 pages of information there. A lot of people get the book, they'll catch me somewhere and start questioning me about this article, and I have to tell them that I would have to see it to know, you know, what they're talking about. But I think that at the time, the early Negro was in a progression movement, trying to move up and out, trying to do better, trying to demonstrate that under the dire circumstances, we can achieve and we can buy a better house or a different house. And the communities was of such that they were very stately and kept very good.
I was so curious, though, about who wrote this document and where it appeared, because it concludes this way. There's all this numerical breakdown, and then there's a paragraph, and this is what it says, and I'm quoting here. Kansas City Negroes challenge any other city in this country to show greater progress in individual home buying and more beautiful and well-kept homes. Seeing the Negro in the street is not seeing him as he is in his home life, but here is where the white world passes judgment on him. I so want to know who wrote that and for what audience.
Yeah, that was in the Kansas City Star.
That was in the Kansas City Star?
Yes.
1910. Tell
yes.
me, I mean, what does that say to you?
It says to me that people were looking without a hidden agenda. There was no, how do I say that, no animosity. There was nothing hidden. They just wanted to reveal what was actually happening. And if the history says that the early Negro and even today have to function under some different kinds of rules, and they were functioning under some very strong rules, but yet and still they moved on. They come out of it. They spent. They developed. That's what I think. But it was in Kansas City Star.
We will be right back to this conversation with Sonny Gibson. He's giving a talk this evening at the library. We'll have more information on that talk later in the show. Stick around to hear more from Sonny Gibson or ask him a question by calling 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Sonny Gibson, the author of 1865 Kansas City Early Negro History. It's a compilation of really amazing quantities of memorabilia. This book is heavy. You could build bicep strength by just holding it and lifting it up and down a few times. Sonny Gibson, we were just talking about how all of this information is out there, but it's information we haven't seen before. Why haven't we seen this stuff before?
Well, I think that people who have the ability or groups who have the ability to make this known does not have the interest. And during that time, be it the early 1900s or 1910, 1940, it was just not important to record and present the accomplishments of the early Negro. And so either it was not a conspiracy, I don't think, but the interest was just not there. And so it either was destroyed or it just laid by the wayside and nobody picked it up.
Well, speaking of early accomplishments, there are two institutions that I think are fascinating that I don't think many Kansas Cityans really know much about: the Western College in Kansas City, Missouri, and Western University in Kansas City, Kansas. Could you tell us a little bit about those institutions?
Yeah, in Kansas, Kansas, Western University was a very strong, identified educational institution, and that it was, I think, the dean of that at one time was later by President Theodore Roosevelt. He was became the Register of the Treasury of the United States. That's Willie Tecumseh Vernon. So you had a lot of highly educated people at that time with some very serious thinking values, which I don't think exist today. And Western University was at 2100 block on Tracy, and it was a university that was available for the early Negro to get some education to go in different fields.
Do you think it's strange that most people don't know that these schools ever existed?
Yes, because it wasn't recorded publicly. It was not important, I don't think, at that time.
I actually one time stumbled upon a master's thesis in an archive at the Kansas State Historical Society that was all about Western University. And I found it strange that this thesis seemed to be the only real repository for information about this place. It's in what's now Quindaro. And that this sort of fascinating composer named Nora Holt had come out of that school, which is the only reason I was looking for it. Have you heard about Nora Holt or any other graduates of Western University?
By remembrance, I've seen a lot of different individuals by name that were. It was an industrial school also. And so people of color from all over the world came to Quindaro. Quindaro was at one time Quindaro, Kansas, before it was annexed to Kansas City, Kansas. So it was a real viable community.
Let's hear what Howard in Overland Park has to ask us. Hi, Howard.
Hello, everyone. Earlier you mentioned Blind Boone. I'd like to know if Blind Boone and Scott Joplin knew each other, and if so, did they collaborate with each other? And could you say something about their influence on music around the world? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Howard.
I think that Blind Boone was first.
Yeah, he came first.
And I think that Scott Joplin had to have been influenced by this genius of the piano who completed a symphony to a storm, and but they were not at the same time. They were just different.
Blind Boone comes up several times. He makes several appearances in your book, and it seems like we have a photo of him in his home sitting at his piano, and a photo of him with his manager. Advertisements for shows he performed, and an obituary. What is it about Blind Boone that made his appearance in this book so important to you?
Well, I think that Blind Boone was a concert pianist that appeared not nationally but worldwide. He played before various dignitaries of state, and I think that it's not enough known by him even today. And I was fortunate enough to come across this picture of him in his studio.
Where did you find that?
In a book that a friend of mine gave me. He had no idea the significance, but I pleaded with him to let me have the book, and it's about Blind Boone. He had a manager by the name of John Lang.
Who is also a businessman and philanthropist here in Kansas City,
yeah.
Right?
Also, it's documented that he was a millionaire. And he built the first Negro hospital in Kansas City at 1227 Michigan.
Tell us about that hospital.
Oh, it was, the book indicates all the various disciplines of the hospital, OYBGN or all those kinds of things. And they had nurses, and they had various specialized doctors that dealt with medicine. And so that was an early need for a hospital here in early Kansas City. And he was rich enough, really, as a philanthropist to say, I will build this hospital. And he did.
You know, one of the things I was really struck by when reading this book was how politically organized Kansas City's Black community was very early on. Like in 1917, there's an article about the organization of a group called the Negro Protective League. And you see a lot of letter writing campaigns back and forth with elected officials. Did you already know about these organizing efforts before you began digging, or was that a surprise to you, too?
My early education did not even indicate that these kinds of political activities existed. And I didn't know about any of it until I come across all these various articles.
How did you feel just personally finding it that out?
I felt enriched. I felt that the visual experience to be able to read of those kinds of things that occurred under some very unusual circumstances. You have to have an introspective desire to want to know about these things, and I did.
Let's talk to Richard in Kansas City. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I've been fascinated by the book from 1865, you know, the end of the Civil War forward. But I'm also really curious about what were Negroes, Black people, whatever we call them, doing in Kansas City before 1865? How soon will your next book on before 1865 come out?
Oh, I hear a challenge in that.
there's last Friday, a friend of mine took me to a flea market store on Truman Road, right at the beginning of Independence, Missouri. And there were five volumes of early newspapers that gave me so much information. It's a challenge, but I don't know.
So I think, I mean, can you really go to flea markets and hope to find things from even earlier than 1865? It seems amazing to me how much you found from the early 20th century and late 19th century going even earlier. Is there a place where you think you could go to find those things if you wanted to?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look and search. I went up to Western Missouri one time and I bought a whole big, large box of newspapers. So you just can't look at every single page. You have to decide, well, I'm going to get all this information and later go through it and see what I can find. But it's out there. You just have to search.
Let's talk to Joe in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. I just want to tell my friend Gibson that I'm listening and that a lot of things that I know about the history of Kansas City come from reading his book. And I look forward to the presentation this evening, and I will be there.
Joe, can you tell us, is there something that you learned reading this book that you think about a lot that has changed how you view something in a really important way?
Yes. In the book, I found a lot about a Wayne Minor American Legion 149, which is very significant. And it's celebrating 95 years old today, and especially when we think about African Americans in the world in World War I, and that they were also trained at Western University over in Kansas City, Kansas. His book is excellent if you want to take a look at African American culture and heritages, fraternities, sororities, professional. It's outstanding.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe.
And he does mention fraternities, sororities, social events of all kinds. In addition, you know, there are images of, for example, the staff of an all-Black firehouse and a graduating class from beauty school, that different kinds of achievements are chronicled, even if you haven't written around them, just showing photos of people in graduation caps.
Yes, that's true. But also there's a social columns in the book that indicates how people who would come together, and then there's a description of the color of the tablecloths, the type of the flowers, the menu, who these people were, where they traveled to and fro to be a part of the activity. And I don't think that today there's an entity that will indicate this to the public. So it's amazing.
One of the ways that we learn about people through your book is through obituaries. And one that caught my eye was an announcement that Ollie Harris had died. And his obituary called him the King of Barbecue and says that, quote, white people from all parts of the country while passing through Kansas City visited Ollie Harris's garden wall at 1707 West East 12th Street to get a real piece of barbecued meat. This pointing out that white people went to this place, What does that say to you?
It said to me that whatever the barriers were at that time, if they wanted good barbecue, they had to go to Ollie Harris. He was recognized as the king of barbecue here in Kansas City.
Employment is a running theme in this book. White business owners bragging about their black employees in advertisements and marketing campaigns. An article about black prosperity in Kansas City starts with the line, "Prosperity comes from labor." And right next to that, you've placed an ad for a training school for housemaids where women could learn cooking, both plain and fancy. That has to be a strategic layout decision on your part.
It was. I was amazed when I come across it that they had a school to train maids and janitors and things like that. But then I began to recognize this, that those were the employment opportunities that was mostly available. And so you had to really know how to perform in order to get those opportunities. So I thought it was interesting, and I wanted a lot of people to know that it existed.
There was a visit from Marcus Garvey in 1922 that you also have a lot of paraphernalia around. What to you is the significance of a visit like that? First of all, refresh people's memory in case they need it about Marcus Garvey.
Marcus Garvey was the forerunner for a lot of movements in this country relating to African Americans. But for Marcus Garvey, he had what's called the United Negro Improvement Association. And they had several branches here in Kansas City and they had different businesses that employed the Negro. But a lot of people today have no idea. They know about Marcus Garvey, but they didn't know he came to Kansas City.
Why is it important that he came here?
You have to know a lot about Marcus Garvey and its movement. But he was an inspiration because at that time there was no star that people could really look forward to or reach up to. And he would make the opportunities shine. And so for Marcus Garvey to come to Kansas City at St. Stephen's Church, I think was important. And it has become interesting to students who have an idea what Marcus Garvey was about to say, wow, he came to Kansas City.
You know, there were a lot of either ads or articles that referred to specific addresses in Kansas City, like that there was a school in a school in a house for African American children at 15th and Myrtle, and you see a photograph of the house. There were poetry readings at a place at 10th and Charlotte. And as I was reading, it was late at night, and I was actually kind of tempted to jump in my car because I wanted to see, what is that house now? You know, like, what is going on in these places now? Did you do a lot of getting in your car and going to check out, like, random addresses?
Yeah, that first one you mentioned to me, that was the Bruce School. That was a Pacific Negro neighborhood that was developed in like 1898, and it was bounded by specific streets, and they had their own businesses, they had their own custom, their own churches. And so I was fortunate enough to meet the lady whose family owned that particular house. She made that photograph available to me.
Wow. So you got that news, and then you did exactly what I was talking about. You got in your car and went there, and she pulled out a photograph documenting this history.
Yes.
There is something about seeing that guy with his daughter or son cradled in his arms outside the front stoop that really humanizes a picture of people trying to find something better for themselves and their families.
Yeah. And the reason that I enjoy doing that because a lot of times you can have discussions with individuals who have no knowledge of what occurred, and they would immediately say, oh, well, that never happened. I never heard of it before. But when you have photographs that people can look at, you know, they have to say it's something to this. Yes.
Built into a lot of the things we've talked about today is, I feel like, a little bit of a criticism about today, like talking about how people pursued education in a different way at some earlier point in time, or distinguished themselves in some different way at an earlier point in time. How do you feel about where we stand in terms of race relations right now in Kansas City?
That's a hard question. I think that education is a never-ending process. And once a person is educated, they can distinguish between what is right and what is wrong. But if they are marginally educated, any ill-equipped to deal with the thinking process of what's right or what's wrong or what should be or what shouldn't be, then you have a lot of problems. I was educated in a segregated school where teachers knew how to pull the best out of you for that you could have an idea about where you should be as you go on in life. I don't think that exists here in Kansas City now. And the race relations, I tend not to even get into that. I know what it was for me. I was born in Texas in a very small town where you couldn't even go on one side of the street. And so they got a lot of conflicts going on, a lot of discussions about it, but I never get into it.
Sonny Gibson, historian and author of 1865 Kansas City Early Negro History, thank you for being here today.
And I thank you for the opportunity.
Sonny Gibson will speak at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Library this evening at 6:30. The library encourages attendees to RSVP for the event at kclibrary.org. When Central Standard returns, we'll continue our discussion of the people's history, but we'll change locations. Next stop, Ireland. Stay with us.